Welcome to Canucks Central at Noon. Your Vancouver Canucks live here.
Drops off for Horvat, back to Hitler, then to Horvat at the slot. He scores! Bo Horvat in overtime!
On the home of hockey, Sportsnet 650.
Landeskog turned it over to Horvat, right to the slot. Pettersson scores! Is there anything this kid can't do?
Here's Scott Rintoul and Mick Nizar.
Time for Canucks Central as we work from the AM into the PM. Scott Rintoul with you. I'm in North Vancouver. Justin Morissette taking over the board. He's in Van. That leaves Mick Nizar in Coquitlam, where he has been for quite some time. How are you, sir?
Loving it. Sun's starting to poke out here in Coquitlam, so all good.
Sun's out, guns out?
Not quite guns. I don't really have guns, so.
You will at the end of this.
No, I think we're overstating how far I will go. But I've been impressed with my progress so far.
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit yesterday. You, like a lot of people, are saying, okay, you know what? I don't want to be one of those people who gets terribly out of shape or further out of shape during this period of isolation or quarantine. So I'm going to do my best to do my at-home fitness. I never did ask you what the goal was. Was it to become leaner? Was it to become bigger? Like, are you going to be a guy who just has these giant biceps and chest? Is that what you're going to roll back in with?
No, definitely not. I think leaner is the goal.
All right. Leaner. So we're going to see a slimmed down version of Mick Nizar. You're going to look
Michael
Phelps
by the end of
this.
Yeah, and then a more efficient Mick Nizar. How about that?
I like it. A more efficient Mick Nizar. And efficiency is something you were pitching today. When most people take office of whatever kind, they roll up their 100-day plan. Here's what I'm going to do in the first 100 days. Now, if somebody told you they could do it in half that time, all of those things, or less than half the time, probably you would sign up for that plan. And you are proposing a 43-day plan today.
Yeah, it's a neutral site playoff. We briefly talked about it on the program yesterday with Elliot Friedman, kind of sat asking the question, you know, what is there even talk of it? And, you know, not that he was reporting, it just, the league is obviously going to be open to many different solutions, right? And Chris Johnson on 960 yesterday as well, talking about what could a 24-team neutral site playoff, if that's a potential. I think we have to open our minds to what could different scenarios look like, right? So I spent some time last night looking at, you know, is this something that is feasible? And if this is something that people would be into. So I want to pitch it to you and as well the listeners, 650, 650. But I have two early stipulations that I want to get into with you.
And just before we get to those, I just want to outline to people part of the reason neutral site games and a neutral site tournament, if you will, are being proposed because we just don't know where areas that are harder affected are going to be. And if you're going to use arenas without fans, which is what a lot of people think, if the NHL is able to get back up and running, well, let's start considering ones that are outside of larger urban centers or at least centers that are hit right now by coronavirus and COVID-19. So that's part of the backdrop for all of this happening.
For sure. And we'll replay this clip from Elliot Friedman just talking about, you know, the whole genesis of this idea as well. So this is Elliot from last night on the program with Andrew Walker and Satir Shah.
I don't know if it's likely, but I do believe that is something that has been kind of kicked around. I want to be careful with this kind of stuff, Sat, because I don't want it turned into report that this could happen. It's more like, I think everything is potentially on the table. So could I see the possibility of, you know, if we get back close enough and some teams can't play yet in their cities? Yeah, I could see that. I know at one point the NBA talked about, do we have our playoffs? Or at least it was being, I'm not sure it was how far it was, but it was being spitballed around. What if we have our playoffs in one or two cities and bring all the teams there? I don't even know if that's possible anymore, Sat, but I do think these are the kinds of ideas that have been thrown around.
All right. So first stipulation is it's all in one city. We know that much. Second one, obviously there's no fans, right? We're going to continue on the social distancing. There's no fans. And I know that that already kind of sucks, but we're just going to live in that world. So here's what we're going to do, Scott. And I want you to poke holes this as we go along. Maybe I haven't thought everything through. We're bringing in 24 teams so nobody can complain. And it, as it so happens, if you look at the league standings, 24 teams have 70-plus points.
And part of the reason for that as well, sorry, Bick, not to cut you off, but part of the reason for that, and I heard Elliot say this yesterday on your show, Chicago and Montreal are those 23rd and 24th teams, and they happen to have a lot of people who would watch, so that might be part of the thinking here.
For sure. And again, that way there's no complaints. You can't really do like 19 teams. So 24, it's a nice even number. And we're going to do this kind of World Cup style. We're going to break them up into groups. So we're not going to do like play-in games. We're going to have a 9-day round robin, and it's compressed relative to World Cup because you don't have weeks between games. Hockey players are used to playing every single day or every other day. So you have four groups of six, and basically everybody plays each other once, and the top two teams definitely advance. And then the next four, the four best of the 3-4 seeds, would also move on. And you just term it by goal differential and, you know, goals for, goals against. That's how the tiebreak would go. So in 9 days, you could play 36 games, right? Just to do the round robin. And that's a fair way. Everyone gets a shot. There's no play-in game. There's no random upsets. You basically earn your way in. Is that fair?
Well, I see some unfairness to this already based on the fact that teams that are like the Boston Bruins are going to have the same play-in possibility as the Montreal Canadiens to determine seeding. That seems
right,
to be a problem.
Right, but they're also significantly better, right? Like,
theoretically. I mean, we're coming off a layoff here. The problem I see originally, and again, I'm not going to scrap your idea completely, but the fact that there isn't as much waiting here to what these teams have already done seems to be an issue to me, especially on, hey, they're going to play everybody and it's a one-off. It's hockey. Anything can happen in a one-off.
Right, but if you have a play in games and then the juggernaut team is just waiting, how many games have they had to get ready for playoff games, right? If it feels like you're already playing behind the eight ball. At least this way, everyone's starting from the same point.
I understand theory. I'll let you go on. I will continue to poke holes as we go.
Okay, so that's day one, or the first stage. Then you take 2 days off, so just so everyone can get reset. So we're at day 12 here. And I'm thinking best of three, or you could do, again, we're looking for creative ideas, two-game aggregate. So that compresses the total number of days, and this is all about preserving the integrity of next season as well. So if we start in July, you could be finished in August, and you save next season as well. So best of three or two-game aggregate, and then it's basically just round by round thereafter. You get your 16 teams, you're down to eight. And then for rounds two, three, and four, this is where I have some flexibility, but I want to pitch it to you. You could do best of seven series. And if you do best of seven, you're getting away from that 43-day plan. But could you come up with a creative four-game way to do this? Now, you could either do it by four-game aggregate. You could do four games first to 20. Whatever it is, if you keep it to four games for the remaining three rounds, that's how you get to 43 days. Now, the benefit of it is you get it to 43 days. Everything stays preserved. The downside is it's not traditional way of handing out the Stanley Cup.
So, yeah, that's the biggest issue I have with the four-game format is that we need to preserve the integrity of this cup. If they are so concerned with handing the cup out, and look, there are going to be people that talk about the circumstances around this no matter what, the same way you would talk about the circumstances around Chicago's win in 2013. Hey, they were full value, they won, but let's keep in mind it was a 48-game season or the first time a lockout came around in the mid-90s. Same sort of thing. Hey, New Jersey won. Hey, let's just keep in mind these are the circumstances. So I'm not talking about putting an asterisk on that. I do think that four games really challenges the integrity of what this cup means and what these playoffs mean in this sport.
Sure, and I'm here for best of sevens. It would just increase the length of this, right? And just doing it this way, this is the minimum number of games. I think this gets you to 80 games total. And the last five seasons, playoffs have averaged 88 games. So you get fairly close to that number. And if you go to best of sevens, okay, we're surpassing that number now, but we're also making the playoffs longer. But there's enough room here that if you start in mid to late July, you could get out of here by late August, early September. So there's a way to actually do the neutral site that would still work.
Yeah, and I like that aspect of this proposal because I do think you're going to have to turn this thing around in a certain amount of time so that you can preserve the integrity of next season, what that looks like, and another way to generate revenue. And that's a big part of this as well. A big reason they want to have a tournament of some sort, award a cup in some fashion, is because of the lost revenue. And while you're never going to make all of it up, let's make up some of it. You also have to make sure you don't, you know, chop off your nose to spite your face here. Because if you push this thing too far, now you're talking about decrease in revenue next season if you have to limit that schedule. And so you got to figure out how that all comes out. So I like that aspect of this. My biggest problem with your plan that I have is the way the seeding is done at the start. And I would adhere more to something that says, look, the top eight teams in the league, you guys have played your way into a bye through that seeding process. You're getting a seed because we have 70 or more games in most cases this year to show us that you are one of the top eight teams. And we can't just throw that out and make you have the same process. During that time that other teams are seeding or having their play into the tournament you propose, have those top eight teams have controlled scrimmages to knock some of the rust off. They know they're going to be no hitters to a certain degree, but at least they're out there playing. They're knocking some of the rust off. They're getting some of their timing back. But I would not have those top eight teams have the same play-in process as those other 16 that you talk about.
Right, but it's also a TV product, right? You're just coming back, and you want to sell this to some degree. You're not going to have Boston, St. Louis, Tampa Bay, Colorado, Washington, Philly play at all?
I'll have them play.
I guess Pittsburgh and Vegas, right? Like, they're not competitive games. You're trying to sell this to the public as well. Are they tuning in?
I don't need to televise that. I'm sorry. I would rather have the best teams playing in the dance than the potential for a team like Boston having a couple of bad one-offs or a couple of bad bounces with everything they've done and get a bad seed and screw up the early part of this tournament.
It's three games. You should be able to overcome that. It's the same as a four-game series. Like, look what happened to Columbus and Tampa Bay, right? That a couple of bad bounces and they lose that series. Your best team didn't advance in that scenario. You should have to earn your way through the entire competition.
They've already earned their way into the playoffs. Why should they have to earn anything else?
Right, but they don't get a bye in the first round if we play in a regular playoffs. You still have to earn your way through the entirety of the playoffs.
Well, there's eight other teams that would not even be in this discussion. So while we're talking about not getting a bye, why not? There's eight teams, Montreal, Chicago specifically, but there's teams like Arizona that you can make a very good argument have no business even being in this type of tournament.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But there's also a reality is this. We don't necessarily always get the 16 best teams in the playoffs as well, right? But go back to the Vancouver-Calgary series a few years back. It's not as if they were 15 and 16 as far as best in the NHL.
Well, we can make that argument, but again, that comes back to subjectivity. Well, it's like all those Leafs fans arguing the three best teams in hockey last year all resided in the same division. Turns out they didn't. Turns out they actually didn't, and part of that is that you get teams where there is disparity in divisions that are able to pump up their point totals because they play some of the crappier teams in the league. For example, Ottawa and Detroit reside in the same division, so you're beefing up your point totals a little bit. So the argument that, well, Vancouver and Calgary in that year that you referenced weren't some of the 16 best teams, there's so many factors involved in determining that, and that's kind of what an 82-game schedule is laid out to do. You've got ample opportunity
I'll
over that time.
I'll fine-tune this, and I'll bring you a different version that doesn't have the top eight tomorrow.
Yeah, and again, like, I don't think that everything about the plan is shoddy. I just that would be my biggest issue with the plan. I like the way you've rolled it out. I like the fact that it's condensed and you can get it done, and it allows for a bigger window for when this starts. And the beginning of that is the IOC and the decision they finally came to get rid of the Olympics. That opens this window further. And yeah, I don't know where they think the end date is now, Bick, but I know that they think the start date is a lot further down the road than it originally was.
But one other thing, too, a benefit of not having the eight teams you mentioned is it probably shortens the window, right? You wouldn't have to play as many games now to get through this kind of round robin stage. And if you wanted to have a truer sense of what the future rounds would be, well, that's a way to do it as well. You could at least extend those because now you're shortening the play-in games to some degree.
I like the fact that you came up with a creative proposal. That's what this time is for. And as you said, you wanted me to poke holes. I've tried to poke my holes. It's Scott Rintoul. It is Bick Nizar. This is Canucks Central. Harmon Dale's going to join us in 20 minutes time or just under that. He's from The Athletic. And we're going to talk about the defense today of the Vancouver Canucks. It was the most glaring area of need in the first 2 years on the job for Travis Green. it can still be argued that is still the biggest area of need with the Vancouver Canucks. Just overall, before we start getting into individual players and individual pairings here, Bic, what is your thought on how much this defense is improved from the one we saw last season?
It's night and day. Well, two things have happened. Obviously, Quinn Hughes' injection into the lineup on a full-time basis has blown away all of our expectations. He's become a real number one D-man. And because of that, the second thing that's happened is suddenly everybody looks like they're slotted in the right spot. And we could talk about different guys being in different roles. Like Chris Tanev is playing on the first pairing with Quinn Hughes, but he's effectively being used as like the number four style D-man. And you have him in a different spot. Troy Stetcher is playing in a role with Alex Edler, who's, you know, really strong, still having a good season. And so he's probably overqualified as a number three, but Troy Stetcher's probably a number five, but now he's playing as in that second pairing role, and it evens out. And suddenly you have an overqualified Tyler Myers for the third pairing, and like everyone's just in the right spot, or they're overqualified to do their job, or if they're going up in the lineup, they're with someone else who's a stud for, you know, now, relative to their role. So like everything just fits better.
And there are people who are going to hear that and say, third pairing defenseman Myers, why are you paying this guy $6 million? Forget about the salaries for the purpose of this discussion right now. We can talk about individuals and we can talk about the contracts. The bottom line with Myers was, if you want this player and you feel you need this player to overall improve your defense, this is what it's going to cost you. They paid it. We will talk about the contract. In this first year, it's not as bad as some people would have you make out, but this has always been about the end of the deal for Tyler Myers, not the beginning of that deal. There are a couple of underrated stories that you touched on there, and one of them is the health of Chris Tanev. This, second to Quinn Hughes, this to me is the biggest development with the defense corps this year, or the biggest reason behind it. And I do think for everything Hughes has done, I think he gets too much credit for Chris Tanev staying healthy. At some point, we have to give Tanev a little bit of credit, and the fact that maybe he was just due for a season like this, does it help? Absolutely. But Tanev's ability to stay healthy right until the end here, and again, if there is any type of playoff or season resumption, that will be one of the blessings in disguise for that Vancouver blue line. He has been a big part of the way this has played out on the back end.
Yeah, the whole conversation shifts if he's out for a month, right? And we aren't seeing this massive season from 69 games so far. The conversation about him is similar to what we had with Jacob Markstrom yesterday. It's okay. So much of this is trending towards a off-season decision, right? I still look at this as you have to walk away from Chris Tanev, and I know that sucks because he's been such a warrior and all that. But what he's provided this season to me kind of forms a mold of the type of player you want down the road with Quinn Hughes. Quinn Hughes is going to be the star of whatever pairing he's on, and he probably no longer needs a safety blanket, but you kind of have an idea of what a guy next to him would look like.
That's fair, and you can't always go find a guy like Chris Tanev, but, and again, this is a bigger discussion for down the road. Let's say they do move off Chris Tanev. Let's say he can find more money elsewhere, and he chooses to go do that. When you are looking to replace that player in your lineup and you don't think you have the right guy within your organization, it's pretty attractive when you can say to a free agent, here's where we see you. Beside number 43, we might not be offering you more money than another team, but we're offering you an opportunity that is better than any you're going to find on the open market.
Yeah, and the other interesting part too is like how Tyler Myers fits into this. Now, different players, right? But do you want to play a different style with Quinn Hughes as well? Do you want to be more offensive? And I would be very interested to see what a full-time pairing of Hughes and Myers would look like. And that's something we didn't really get to see this year. Just if those two could be more offensive, and if you get Quinn Hughes away from Chris Tanev, is that a future role? If you're paying big money already for Tyler Myers, so do you put him with Quinn Hughes down the road and you save money on your Tanev replacement and he goes lower in your lineup?
Well, we also talk about familiarity and chemistry within pairs, but Travis Green, Nolan Baumgartner, they showed throughout the year that they were willing to mix these defensive pairings up. Sometimes it was because of injury. Other times it was because of ineffectiveness in the case of a Jordy Benn, who got off to a decent start but then didn't have the type of year a lot of people were expecting him to, and they preferred Oscar Fantenberg for the most part in that third pairing. But this is a guy in Myers who started with Edler, eventually made his way down into that third pairing that you talked about, but he was going to get power play time. He was going to get penalty kill time. There are other ways to get guys minutes, and Myers might be the best example of that in this Canucks decor.
Yeah, when you go through some of the shot metrics and the scoring chances metrics, when Tanev and Hughes play together, it's fairly neutral. And when Myers and Hughes play together, the scoring chances go up and the scoring chances against actually go down. So there's some indications that it would kind of work, that you kind of become a more of an aggressive team with those two together. And that's ultimately where this is going to trend for the Canucks, that if you start playing Hughes and his D partner more with Elias Pettersson and get that five-man group out more often, well, they're really going to dominate. And it's kind of goes back to how much like Ehrhoff was playing with the Twins back in that era, that Quinn Hughes basically can become a fourth forward with the group, that the other guy I think is less important, but Tyler Myers is a way to just reutilize your decor.
Hughes is obviously the game changer and alters the look completely at the back end, or at least what you think about one player, and he is the most talented player on defense they have ever had in their organization. I don't think there's any question about that. Whether he realizes his full potential, we will wait and see. The other big difference from this year to last year and the year prior to that, no longer, regardless of what you think of each of these guys individually, no longer does this coaching staff go into a game saying, how do we hide this guy tonight? Like, how do we shelter this particular player? Because I'm not sure we want him out there very much. And that was a game in, game out discussion for this coaching staff, even though they would never admit it publicly. That was a thing for the first 2 years, Bick.
Oh, for sure. And yeah, like who would be the candidates now? Like, I think we can look back and say the version of Ben Hutton, and he's had a good season in LA this year, but the version of Ben Hutton that the team got the previous 2 years needed to be, to some degree, sheltered. And there was Derek Pouliot, obviously. Like, Oscar Fantenberg has issues, but he's also not pushed up the lineup that he needs to be in those scenarios, right? I'm not sure if Ben Hutton in the role Oscar Fantenberg is in right now, would he have the same amount of success? And Fantenberg's had his struggles, but who do you project would have more success in that role?
Yeah, there isn't somebody that jumps out to me. There really isn't. Like, between those guys, I mean, you could argue that Ben Hutton would, but again, this is also, how are you going to fill that role financially? And that was part of the discussion. It's not that Ben Hutton couldn't have come back to this team this year. He just couldn't have come back at his cap hit.
Oh, for sure. And the value of what Fantenberg is bringing you far away. He's probably met his value. Right. And I know there's been some complaints about his game, but you're paying $850,000 for that level of player and he's lived up to his contract. So the mistakes are part of the territory when you're paying that sort of money for a 6'7" D man.
Yeah, I can't argue with that whatsoever. And Hutton, he didn't get what he was hoping to get on the open market, but he made almost double what Fantenberg made this year. He got
The only guy that's been a disappointment is probably Jordy Benn. And I use disappointment in air quotes because I still think there's more to his game and he can live up to the deal. We expected to see more games. And once Oscar Fantenberg got in and they went on that long run, it was going to be tough for Jordy Benn to break the lineup. But he's a guy that there is still more there if and when they do come back.
Well, and here's part of the interesting discussion with that going forward. We can get into this with Harmon Dale, who's going to join us in just a few minutes' time. Jordy Benn's best value might be on the other side of the ice. And when he was forced to play on the right side, that was arguably his best game of the season, or one of them. It was certainly his best game in a while. And if they end up moving on from Tanev, and if they're not willing to pay Stetcher or use him as a trade chip, not that I'm telling you they should. I'm saying if that's what they choose to do, perhaps it's with, hey, Jordy Benn, we're going to actually play him on the right side next year instead of on the left. We'll see where that goes. Hit us with your questions. We've got one coming in right now at 650-650. We'll get to on the other side. That and the Athletics, Harmon Dale next on Canucks Central and your home of Canucks Hockey, Sportsnet 650.
Now more of Canucks Central on the official home of the Vancouver Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Justin Morris at Spinning Tunes back in Mission Control. Scott Rinto, Bick Nizar, this is Canucks Central. We're coming your way every single day, hopefully making your day a little bit better. Sunshiny skies in the lower mainland. That's going to go away relatively quickly, so if you can get out for a walk today, again, keep your safe distance. Bick, you'll get outside at some point today, correct?
I definitely have to, yes.
Absolutely, man. It's important.
Really,
it's important
really
for your physical and mental well-being. What's that?
Really running low on cereal, so I got to get out at some point.
Yeah, everybody likes cereal. Like, there's no one who doesn't, who you know, there's no one who hates cereal, but you like it a little more than everyone.
I'm a cereal connoisseur.
You are the Jerry Seinfeld of this station in that regard.
Thank
Scott
you.
In North Vancouver, just before we get to Harmon Dale, it's not me sending us a text, but Scott in North Vancouver says, saw an article regarding compliance buyout candidates. It included, in his terms, surprisingly, Louis. What are your thoughts on this? Well, it's not surprising whatsoever. If there are compliance buyouts as part of this next CBA or any type of alteration as to what the salary cap might look like next year, if there is no cap charge moving forward, which was what a compliance buyout is, Louis Erickson's getting bought out. No question.
So we brought this up the other day, I think on Friday on the program, and Walks made an interesting point. What if, because you're going to leverage the Louis Erickson thing situation no matter what this summer, right? Like if everything was normal, you were going to send him down, try to quote unquote force him to retire, right? Is that fair?
Yep.
So what if you just stayed true with that plan and you compliance buy out someone like Jay Beagle and there's $3 million you can get off your books at the bottom part of your roster, and then you still continue with your send Louis Erickson down and hope he retires plan. And that way you can kind of hit two birds with one stone.
Yeah, I get it. I think that's wishful thinking. I think the opportunity to eat your cake and have it too won't exist, because while that might be your plan, guess who else knows what that plan is? Louis Erickson. And so Louis Erickson might say, cool, I'll go ride the bus. Can you really afford to take that chance? It becomes a game of poker at that point in time, and I don't think you want to get caught holding the bag. I think you just suck it up, you eat it, you make that compliance buyout, and move on.
But his reality is still the same, though. He would still be going in down to the AHL.
Sure. He's also still collecting all of his money. And what's more important? Louis Erickson spending a year on the bus and going, hey, we think we can wait him out, or getting that cap charge off your books no matter what?
The interest intrigues me. The potential intrigues me of trying to do both.
Sure, of course. Of course the potential intrigues you. I just don't think it's realistic. There's a lot of people that thought they were going to do that this season, and it became abundantly clear through their dealings with Louis Erickson that that wasn't going to happen. And I do think there was a situation where Louis Erickson was riding the bus in Utica at some point this year. It just never materialized, as a couple of guys they wanted to beat him out in camp never did. They said, well, we're kind of pot committed in what we want to do with this season, and whether we like it or not, he's one of our best 13, so we're keeping him here right now.
I would just be kind of surprised if he, out of spite because you didn't compliance buyout, didn't retire.
Maybe. Maybe, but 2 years, I know after you pay the bonus, things look a little different.
Still, yeah, there's what, $5 million left?
It's still a decent amount of money. Like, $5 million is still a lot of money, man.
Oh, totally. Absolutely.
So, again, that would be playing a little bit of poker. I think it's more important to get the buyout off the books. I understand what Wachs is saying and what you're speculating on there as well. Harmon Dale, he understands it. He understands a lot about the Vancouver Canucks, which is why we bring him on. He's from The Athletic, and he joins us now. Harmon, how are you today? Oh, maybe he's not there. Maybe JMO's right. Having quite the conversation with him.
Maybe I floored him with my bio J. Beagle idea.
I think he and yeah, maybe it's that. I think he. Oh, see, Marcet's laughing, so I know that Marcet was having a conversation with Armin on the line. Armin, thank you very much for doing this. How are you?
All right.
Armin, can you hear us now? There he is. I know you're on the line. We didn't hear your answer. Are you doing well, Armin? Are you safe and healthy?
Oh, yes, I am. Sorry, I didn't hear you guys. When I got put on, I just heard blank. I'm doing well. What was the question, guys?
Oh, we're just asking how you were doing. We understand there's technological challenges right now. You're working from home like everybody else right now. Obviously, it's impacted your day today as you go about your job trying to write for The Athletic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, really, and I imagine you guys can attest to this best, trying to do sports radio with no sports going on. It's definitely a challenge, and from my perspective, just trying to do my best to get in touch with people over the phone, and try and find unique angles and continue covering hockey the best way we can.
I'm not sure if that challenge is greater than what Nolan Baumgartner and Travis Green had with their defensive core the first 2 years, but I digress. To you, Harmon, what is the biggest indicator of improvement in this group overall from last season to this season?
Well, I think it starts, number one, with the addition of Quinn Hughes, obviously, and it's pretty crazy to think about where he's at now and where the expectations were going into the season. I mean, to have a 20-year-old rookie defenseman step into the league right away and make his mark and establish himself as a bona fide number one defenseman. You're seeing sort of the same thing in Colorado with Cale Makar, and you take it for granted, but this is virtually unprecedented. It's very rare to see a young defenseman be able to make that type of impact right away. And it's not only the type of offensive difference Hughes is making as one of the NHL's top offensive blue liners, but just his two-way impact as well. And that's what has really allowed Travis Green the trust to play him in matchup minutes, is the maturity of his two-way game. And just having someone who can play those big minutes, that has a trickle-down effect and helps out someone like Alex Edler, who over time, he of course, has been slowing down a little, and for him to take a little bit less of a workload, that helps his game out. And so he is a game changer, and that really gives you 20, 25 minutes a night where you're able to control the flow of play and transition the puck up the ice well. So I think he makes the biggest difference. And then, of course, to have someone like Tyler Myers added to the top four as well, that's a huge help. So between those two guys, you can just see the ability of this team to transition the puck up the ice has improved so much, especially when you consider who was subtracted in the likes of Eric Goodbranson and Derek Pouliot.
When it comes to Quinn Hughes, like, I think we thought there would be some points there. Are you surprised that it's been this level, right? While we highlight the two-way play and he's been far better defensively than I think we ever anticipated, like, the astonishing numbers that he's putting up is blowing away even our expectations.
Absolutely. We figured that he would be able to quarterback the top power play unit and rack up some points, but it's kind of similar to Elias Pettersson last year, where you wouldn't have expected him to rack up these numbers. I mean, he had a legitimate shot here to, and it would have been an outside chance, but to beat Pettersson's rookie point record. I mean, he's top five among NHL defensemen in points already. These are the type of numbers I expected. I mean, you talk about 53 points in 68 games. That's what I imagined, I think, peak Quinn Hughes might have been when the Canucks originally drafted him, and that would have been sort of a best-case scenario. So he's blown all expectations out of the water. And, I mean, I keep making the comparison between him and Pettersson, but it's just so apt. I mean, we knew these guys had the potential to be superstars in the league, but we didn't know that it would happen right away. Like, when it came to Pettersson last year, we were saying maybe he can be a 40-point guy, a 40, 50-point player With Quinn Hughes, I was thinking maybe he can finish the season with 40 points, and that would be like an A-plus type season, and he had a shot to hit 60-plus here. So, I mean, he's exceeded even the most optimistic expectations.
You mentioned there Tyler Myers as well just a brief minute ago. Obviously, he was the big acquisition. And like I've come to use the term, he's the inkblot D-man, that if you're anti-Tyler Myers, you're going to see what you want to see. And if you're pro-Tyler Myers, you're going to see what you want to see. Just judging his season as a whole, have the Canucks gotten value just for 1 year out of that contract?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about value as far as a $6 million player, I think that would be hard to justify because that's top pairing value. But as far as whether he's been a positive contributor, absolutely. He's been a very solid number four quality defenseman to me. And he's shown the ability. I mean, first month of the season, he goes up and the Canucks had a very hot October that sort of set the tone for the season. And when he played alongside Alex Edler, he did so against the opposition's best players, and that pairing was an integral part of the team's early success. And as the season sort of went on, as you mentioned, he's a very divisive player in that, and I like to make the Jake Gardner comparison. You see what you want to see out of Myers because he does have these sort of loud mistakes, but at the same time, if you sort of take a step back and look at whether the pros outweigh the cons, the answer would be yes. He does a lot more good than he does bad. His two-way profile, the Canucks, when Myers steps on the ice, they're doing a much better job of controlling shots and scoring chances compared to when he's on the bench. And it reflects in the goal differentials as well. The Canucks aren't getting out, you know, scored by significant margins when he's been deployed. And he has been put in a tough circumstance. Early in the season, he's playing top competition, and then yes, later in the season through the second half, he's put alongside Oscar Fantenberg, and you think that's a little bit more of a limited role. But if you take sort of a peek under the hood and look at Fantenberg's performance, he's been one of the NHL's worst defensemen at controlling play, and so Myers has had to navigate through that. And from my perspective, I think all things considered, the Canucks have gotten pretty good value in their first year with Tyler Myers, maybe not fully justifying that $6 million cap hit, but definitely he's exceeded my expectations in his first season wearing blue and green.
In conversation with The Athletic's Harmon Dahl today on Canucks Central and your home of Vancouver hockey, Sportsnet 650. Apply that same lens to Troy Stetcher. How do you evaluate his season?
Honestly, and for me to put the context and perspective out there, I've usually been a big proponent of Stetcher's game. I think he's shown in seasons past that maybe he started on a bottom pairing, but as injuries sort of went on and the Canucks had limited defensive depth, he would sort of creep up and solidify himself in the top four. So I really like his game, but this season, I think for most of the year, it's been a tough going, and I think he's underperformed my expectations, I'd say. And it's just sort of strange. I mean, I remember the first moment he was paired with Jordy Benn, I figured that would be an opportunity for the Canucks to sort of, I thought that was an above average third pair, and for whatever reason, it just didn't click. And when I looked at Stetcher's game, what looked different was he just seemed, I mean, a big strength of his game when he's on it is his ability to move the puck up the ice and lead possession breakouts. And that just wasn't there for most of this season. He seemed under duress a lot of the time. He seemed to have issues with puck retrievals and sort of making plays and sort of he seemed like he was a step behind. It always seemed that he had forechecking pressure on him, and so his transition game just in my opinion hasn't been up to par. And then he has had defensive mistakes here and there. That's another part of his game where I've always thought his own zone play has been relatively solid, and this season it just quite hasn't been there. So to my eyes, he's been more of a number 5-6 this season. I think he's nowhere near sort of the disappointment that I might have in someone like Jordy Benn, but I think he's been below par relative to sort of the higher standards that I evaluate him on.
Both he and Chris Tanev are free agents of varying manners this summer. The Canucks could move on from both. They could retain both. If you were in that GM's chair, what would you do?
Look, I think if you look at Vancouver's cap situation, they're right up against it. There's no secret, and especially with Jacob Markstrom and Tyler Toffoli, to me, those are two guys that are higher on the priority list than someone like Chris Tanev, and I say that for a variety of different reasons, but most importantly, I mean, just look at the contract someone like Anton Stralman got in free agency last year, and Stralman was a 33-year-old. He had a worse season than Tanev. He played in less games, put up less points, and he got 5.5 per year times 3 years to the Florida Panthers. And so now you look at Chris Tanev. I'm worried about what any type of contract he signs looks like, because you look at him now. He's 30 years old. He's got a lot of miles on his body, an extensive injury list. And look, I mean, that's a symptom of the fact that he's been a warrior for this team for so many years and put his body and sacrificed his health for the organization. But it's scary to think about what age-related decline and how that might combine with the injuries that he's already sustained throughout his career. I'm wary of a long-term extension that might be in the $5 million, maybe even $6 million territory. So to me, I look at Tanev, I just don't think you can justify it on a long-term basis. And if that's the case, I mean, Troy Stetcher would come in a lot cheaper. And to me, if you can, especially being a local hometown kid, it wouldn't surprise me if he actually signed something pretty close to his qualifying offer, which I believe is 2 and change. So if you could lock him up for, say, $2.5 million, I think the way you have to kind of look at it is this. With Vancouver's salary cap situation, they're going to need to find efficiency somewhere. If Troy Stetcher is a player who can, let's say, give you 75% of what Chris Tanev brings to the table, but he's doing so for 40 or 50% of the cost, then that's something that the Canucks might have to consider if it allows them to re-up someone like Tyler Toffoli.
The other thing I look at too, Harmon, when it comes to that contract for Chris Tanev, and he's going to get a raise from what he's making right now, 4.45. And you can't be paying $5+ million for non-power play players, no matter how good they are defensively. And, you know, he brings defensive value, but he's not like elite as far as shutting guys down. He's very strong, but he's paid the right price. And you look at contracts that have been handed out both on left-hand and right-side D-mans for expensive penalty killers. They don't exactly live up to that contract. And if you're going to hand out money, that's why the Tyler Myers one I look at, it's like, okay, $6 million. And yes, he's going to have defensive issues, but you're going to get goals out of him. You should get a lot more points than he's been given because of the power play deployment. But you start trending in a way that you're overvaluing your penalty kill. Well, that's how teams get caught into contract problems.
Yeah, and I think what you're seeing is the trajectory of Tanev's two-way play has slowly been deteriorating, and it began last season where you looked at a lot of the underlying data. And to provide context, throughout the prime of his career, Tanev was one of those players sort of in the Nicholas Jalmerson territory as far as his defensive prowess and being one of the NHL's elite defensive defensemen. He was right up there, but he's not at that same level. He's had sort of a slow decline that accelerated last year, and you notice it when you watch him skate with his ability to sort of, again, I keep talking about moving the puck up the ice. It's so important in the modern game, and his feet sort of seemed to start to slow down last season, and his ability to escape pressure in his own zone just wasn't quite the same as it was last year. Now, playing with Quinn Hughes this year, I think that's been a best-case scenario for him because he's got someone in Hughes who can sort of take control of the puck and sort of be a one-man breakout machine. But I think, if anything, that's maybe masked some of the sort of, I wouldn't call them deficiencies in his game, but something that's maybe a growing weakness that might be a concern in the long run. And so with Tanev, it's one of those things where I think at this stage of his career, he's already a number four defenseman, and he could quite quickly become worse than that, as we mentioned, with the injuries and the age-related decline that players see through their 30s. So I think we're on the same page here. A contract for Tanev that would stretch long-term would be quite the risk for the Canucks.
We're talking tan, man. Not sure it's sunny enough outside for you to get a tan, man, but we will leave you on that. Harmon, a bad pun gets you out. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Bake.
That is Harmon Dale. I had to throw something cheesy at him at the end there, Bick. It is a beautiful day out there.
I'm going to hang up right now because of that. That was unbelievable.
Perfect. It's the end of the show. That's great, man. That's how I roll. What's coming up on the program this afternoon?
We're going to talk to Justin Bourne, 435, Mark Schofield, 605, as we trend towards the NFL draft. And I'm not sure if I should confirm this, because I don't know if it is confirmed, but I believe we're going to be talking to Travis Green. But we'll wait on that. We'll put out a tweet once it is confirmed.
Keep your eyes on the Sportsnet 650 Twitter feed. Andrew Walker, Sad Shaw, Bick Nizar. You can follow them online as well, and they will let you know. Hopefully, we'll hear from the head coach of the Vancouver Canucks this afternoon. Great stuff, Bick. You and I will reconvene tomorrow. Justin Morissette, thanks for getting it done. I know you laughed when I put the pun out there. You're a fan of wordplay. Coming up next, it is Reach Deep. They go cross country.
You're not encouraging.
Oh, yeah. J-Mo's on my side on this, aren't you, J-Mo?
I will confirm, yes.
Beautiful, beautiful. We are going cross-country coming up next. Dan Riccio in Vancouver. Josh Goldberg giving a perspective from the other side of the country. It's Reach Deep. Bowen Byram joins the program, as does Shane O'Brien. We will talk to you tomorrow, 9 a.m. Scott Rintoul's show goes on Sportsnet 650. Have a great day. This is your home of Vancouver hockey, Sportsnet 650.